Random House Audio presents Until I Find You by John Irving. Read for you by Arthur Morey. Part 1. The North Sea. Chapter 1. In the Care of Churchgoers and Old Girls. According to his mother, Jack Burns was an actor before he was an actor. But Jack's most vivid memories of childhood were those moments when he felt compelled to hold his mother's hand. He wasn't acting then. Of course, we don't remember much until we're 4 or 5 years old, and what we remember at that early age is very selective, or incomplete, or even false. What Jack recalled as the first time he felt the need to reach for his mom's hand was probably the 100th or 200th time. Preschool tests revealed that Jack Burns had a vocabulary beyond his years, which is not uncommon among only children accustomed to adult conversation, especially only children of single parents. But of greater significance, according to the tests, was Jack's capacity for consecutive memory, which, when he was 3, was comparable to that of a 9-year-old. At 4, his retention of detail and understanding of linear time were equal to an 11-year-old's. The details included, but were not limited to, such trivia as articles of clothing and the names of streets. These test results were bewildering to Jack's mother, Alice, who considered him to be an inattentive child. In her view, Jack's propensity for daydreaming made him immature for his age. Nevertheless, in the fall of 1969, when Jack was 4 and had not yet started kindergarten, his mother walked with him to the corner of Pickthall and Hutchings Hill Road in Forest Hill, which was a nice neighborhood in Toronto. They were waiting for school to be let out, Alice explained, so that Jack could see the girls. St. Hilda's was then called a church school for girls, from kindergarten through grade 13. At that time still in existence in Canada, and Jack's mother had decided that this was where Jack would begin his schooling, although he was a boy. She waited to tell him of her decision until the main doors of the school opened, as if to greet them, and the girls streamed through in varying degrees of sullenness and exultation and prettiness and slouching disarray. "Next year," Alice announced, "St. Hilda's is going to admit boys. Only a very few boys, and only up to grade 4. Jack couldn't move. He could barely breathe. Girls were passing him on all sides, some of them big and noisy, all of them in uniforms in those colors Jack Burns later came to believe he would wear to his grave, gray and maroon. The girls wore gray sweaters or maroon blazers over their white midi blouses. "They're going to admit you," Jack's mother told him. "I'm arranging it." "How?" he asked. "I'm still figuring that out," Alice replied. The girls wore gray pleated skirts with gray knee socks, which Canadians called knee highs. It was Jack's first look at all those bare legs. He didn't yet understand how the girls were driven by some interior unrest to push their socks down to their ankles, or at least below their calves, despite the school rule that knee highs should be worn knee high. Jack Burns further observed that the girls didn't see him standing there, or they looked right through him. But there was one, an older girl with womanly hips and breasts and lips as full as Alice's. She locked onto Jack's eyes as if she were powerless to avert her gaze. At the age of 4, Jack wasn't sure if he was the one who couldn't look away from her, or if she was the one who was trapped and couldn't look away from him. Whichever the case, her expression was so knowing that she frightened him. Perhaps she had seen what Jack would look like as an older boy or a grown man, and what she saw in him riveted her with longing and desperation. Or with fear and degradation, Jack Burns would one day conclude, because this same older girl suddenly looked away. Jack and his mom went on standing in the sea of girls until the girls' rides had come and gone, and those on foot had left not even the sound of their shoes behind, or their intimidating but stimulating laughter. However, there was still enough warmth in the early fall air to hold their scent, which Jack reluctantly inhaled and confused with perfume. With most of the girls at St. Hilda's, it was not their perfume that lingered in the air. It was the smell of the girls themselves, which Jack Burns would never grow used to or take for granted, not even by the time he left grade 4.
"But why am I going to school here?"
Jack asked his mother when the girls had gone. Some fallen leaves were all that remained in motion on the quiet street corner.
"Because it's a good school," Alice answered, "and you'll be safe with the girls," she added.
Jack must not have thought so because he instantly reached for his mom's hand. In that fall of the year before Jack's admission to St. Hilda's, his mother was full of surprises. After showing him the uniformed girls who would soon dominate his life, Alice announced that she would work her way through Northern Europe in search of Jack's runaway dad. She knew the North Sea cities where he was most likely to be hiding from them. Together they would hunt him down and confront him with his abandoned responsibilities. Jack Burns had often heard his mother refer to the two of them as his father's abandoned responsibilities. But even at the age of 4, Jack had come to the conclusion that his dad had left them for good. In Jack's case, before he was born. And when his mom said she would work her way through these foreign cities, Jack knew what her work was. Like her dad, Alice was a tattoo artist. Tattooing was the only work she knew. In the North Sea cities on their itinerary, other tattooists would give Alice work. They knew she'd been apprenticed to her father, a well-known tattooer in Edinburgh, officially in the port of Leith, where Jack's mom had suffered the misfortune of meeting his dad. It was there he got her pregnant and subsequently left her. In Alice's account, Jack's father sailed on the New Scotland, which docked in Halifax. When he was gainfully employed, he would send for her, or so he had promised. But Alice said she never heard from him, only of him. Before moving on from Halifax, Jack's dad had cut quite a swath. Born Callum Burns, Jack's father changed his first name to William when he was still in university. His father was named Alasdair, which William said was Scots enough for the whole family. In Edinburgh, at the time of his scandalous departure for Nova Scotia, William Burns had been an associate of the Royal College of Organists, which meant that he had a diploma in organ playing in addition to his bachelor's in music. When he met Jack's mother, William was the organist at South Leith Parish Church. Alice was a choir girl there. For an Edinburgh boy with upper-class pretensions and a good education, William Burns had gone to Heriot's before studying music at the University of Edinburgh. A first job playing the organ in lower-class Leith might have struck him as slumming. But Jack's dad liked to joke that the Church of Scotland paid better than the Scottish Episcopal Church. While William was an Episcopalian, he liked it just fine at the South Leith Parish, where it was said that 11,000 souls were buried in the graveyard, although there were not more than 300 gravestones. Gravestones for the poor were not permitted. But at night, Jack's mom told him, people brought the ashes of loved ones and scattered them through the fence of the graveyard. The thought of so many souls blowing around in the dark gave the boy nightmares. But that church, if only because of its graveyard, was a popular place. And Alice believed she had died and gone to heaven when she started singing for William there. In South Leith Parish Church, the choir and the organ were behind the congregation. There were not more than 20 seats for the choir, the women in front, the men in back. For the duration of the sermon, William made a point of asking Alice to lean forward in the front row so that he could see all of her. She wore a blue robe, blue jay blue, she told Jack, and a white collar.
Jack's mom fell in love.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?